Hello. Come now with me, up and along this wintry path, through the snow-dusted woods, then out over the moors. Mind your footing. Easy to lose your way up here when the snow comes down like tonight, and it gets dark so early. Look up. You're right on time. See that cabin up ahead? Nestled in that copse of silver birches, that's our destination. Look, a warm orange light glows from the window. Someone's lit the fire. And here we are.
Oh, hello. Oh, you're first to arrive. Well, apart from me, obviously, I'm here. Come in. Sorry, let me take your coat.
Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast Christmas Ghost Story Special.
There we go. Oh, well, it's lovely to see you. I'm glad you can make it. Listen, why don't you come over here and just pop yourself in this armchair and relax, and I'll get you a drink. What do you fancy? We've got mulled wine, we've got whiskey, got some nice single malt, or we've got non-alcoholic beverages if you prefer. Right, yeah, good choice, okay.
But wait, what's this on the path outside? There's something there in the darkness, slowly approaching the cabin. Something huge and terrifying. Some kind of hairy creature. Perhaps a bear? But like no bear I've ever seen. Raised up on its hind legs. It comes to the door and bangs against it. Wait! John, no! Don't open the door! It's a...
Oh, hiya, mate.
Hey, oh. Tommy, how you doing, mate? You all right?
Oh, it's Tom. Right, yeah. Sorry. Phew.
Not bad. A bit windy out there, isn't it?
So did you find it all right?
Yeah. It's a bit tricky in all the snow, but yeah. It's a nice spot. Nice spot.
It is. It's a little bit out of the way, isn't it? I won't lie.
It is. I was going to say it's a bit spooky in a way, but...
I mean, it is an excellent location for telling a few ghost stories.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? That's why we're here.
Yeah.
You've decided that nothing is as Christmassy as scaring each other, which...
is that? It's traditional, Tom. It's traditional.
Victorian tradition of...
That's it. Well, yeah, well, should we begin? You want to come over and sit by the fire?
Oh, are we expecting anyone else?
No, not that I know of.
Have you ordered like a Waitrose shop or something?
No.
Right, well, you go and answer it then. You're nearest, aren't you? So I've seen enough horror films to know what a knock like that means, John.
You see, I knew we shouldn't have organised our ghost story readings in, like, some remote cabin up on the snowy moors. I did say, Tom.
Yeah, I know.
It does make you very prone to axe murderers.
It's atmospheric, though, isn't it? Eh? Well, and the thing is, think about it. Mm. Would an axe murderer knock? Eh? They wouldn't, would they? Just let themselves in and start, you know, murdering with an axe.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I honestly haven't had a lot of experience. Do you think axe murderers ever diversify? Do you
think they're ever like... I think the thing is, once you've used an axe, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah,
otherwise
you can't go back,
you're ruining
your
brand.
Do you think they're really disparaging of other means of killing?
I don't know if there's like a hierarchy of different... Oh, she's a poisoner. Yeah. Is she? Dear me.
Bloody knife killers. Fancy schmancy artists.
Yeah, common as muck.
Anyway, we should probably get that.
Yeah, this seems quite insistent.
I'll tell you what, Tom, you take this poker from the fire, you stand behind the door, and I'll ask them if they're an axe murderer, right?
If
they say yes, then you clock them, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Yeah, perfect.
Plan. Okay,
perfect.
Brilliant, let's do it.
Right.
Ready?
Whoa. All right, lads.
Davey!
It's me.
No way!
Oh, come on, let me in. It's bloody freezing out there.
Yeah, come on in, buddy. What's going on?
Is that log fire going?
Come on in.
Oh, thanks very much.
How's it going? What are you doing here? How did you know we were here?
To be honest, I've just been wandering around in the wilderness for 6 months, and I finally saw a cabin.
Oh, you've been lost?
Yeah. I thought I'd come and see you, and it just turned out to be you.
Lost, and now you are found.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's nice and warm. Yeah, it feels warm in here. It's
come and sit down.
Comforting.
Yeah, well, it's very fortuitous that you could join us, Birdie, because we're actually just recording a podcast for Christmas.
Are you now? Is it Christmas
yeah,
already?
We're doing ghost yeah. stories.
Bloody hell.
yeah.
Well, that sounds good. Well, you know, I can join in with that.
All right, great. Well, you might have to make up a ghost story, if you don't mind.
Do you know what? I was just thinking of something scary when I was walking around outside in the snow.
All right, perfect.
So, yeah.
Well,
I can do that.
We've got it. We're all lined up. Should we all go and sit around the fire?
Yeah.
Let's. Has anyone got any booze, any brandy? Or
yeah, I could do your brandy.
Yeah. Yeah, all right.
I'll sort you a brandy.
Can you deliver it in a barrel around the neck of a large dog called Schnorbitz?
Yeah, we can do that. Tom, do you want a whiskey, bourbon?
I'll have a snowball, please, John. Get in the spirit of things.
I'm on it. So we're going to tell some ghost stories.
All right.
Who would like to go first? I feel like we need to give you a little bit of time just to settle down.
Yeah, bed in. Yeah.
Collect your thoughts.
You've been out there in the wilderness a long time.
It's going to take me a while to warm up. So perhaps you could read a story, John.
All right.
Give me plenty of time to get warm.
There is, you know how we talked about maybe trying to keep it under 1,000 words?
Yeah, I think that's important that we do, because we don't want them going on too long.
Well, I just wanted to say...
It's a sign of a bad writer, isn't it, if you can't kind of write within a...
How many have you done?
Mine, it's just it's only a little bit longer than 1,000 words.
Right, okay, well, that's all right.
Oh, like 1,003 yeah, or
by about
like
3,000 words.
Bloody
it's longer.
But you've been writing non-stop since I was last here.
Well, I was intending to finish my book, but then I got carried away with the story. I really enjoyed doing the story, and in my defence, right, I was wanting to draw on the
tradition of overly long, boring stories.
yeah, well, in a way, yeah, I wanted that sort of Victorian Edwardian vibe.
What, the kind of idea that there's nothing else to do in life? There's no TV, yeah. There's no games yeah. or anything.
So
you are just stuck in a room. We may as well stretch it out.
It's either that or go to bed, isn't it?
Yeah. We might as well make the sentences incredibly long and use incredibly long words and be very verbose. Brilliant. So, yeah, so that's what I've done.
It is good to know that some things haven't changed at all.
yeah.
Whilst I've been away.
It's like you've hardly been away, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's lovely.
That's nice.
But anyway, that's my excuse. Well, that's part of the excuse. The other bit of the excuse is that the idea for the story began a few years ago when Katie and I were away for a weekend with some friends, and we were staying on the Holderness Coast, quite near Hull. But in one of the bedrooms, it was quite a spooky place anyway, but in one of the bedrooms of this place we rented...
Sorry, is this actually part of the story?
It's part of the build-up.
Is this like a preamble?
It's preamble, yeah. There was this painting, right?
This isn't included in the word count?
No, it's not. It's not needed.
Okay.
I just feel like you might like to know.
I've got a feeling a lot of your elements of your story are going to be fall into that category.
It's quite possible.
Sorry, carry on.
Anyway, there was this painting of this little girl in this bedroom that a friend of mine was staying in.
Spooky already, yeah.
Yeah, and there was something quite disturbing about this painting. So much so that my mate took the painting from the room, actually removed the picture because he didn't want to sleep in the same room as it.
Oh, blimey.
I think if you see a picture of it, I think you'll know what I mean. We'll post a picture of it in the blog. But, yeah, the picture is... It's... actually, the name of the picture is quite disturbing as it is. Because it's called Cherry Ripe by Sir John Everett Millais. And it's this, I mean, she's very young, isn't she? She's like 6 or 7 years old, this girl. And there's something about her expression, there's something not quite right about it. It's like, it's a sort of adult expression. It's like the kid knows too much, if you know what I mean. It's not right. Anyway,
yeah.
It became a bit of a joke. And whenever we go away with those friends, I'll always take a copy of that painting and put it up in their room somewhere.
Just the kind of nice guy that you are.
Yeah, just to freak them out a little bit. Anyway, so at the time, Katie and I freestyled this little story about this young girl for the kids. So I wanted to take the essence of that story and turn it into more of a ghost story. So it needed a bit more filling out. That's my long-winded way of saying, I'm sorry it's long, but it sort of needed to be. Are you sitting comfortably?
Not comfortably enough for 4,000
words. Dave's debating now whether to run back out into the wintry wilderness.
Just start running, yeah.
What have I done?
Let me just set me alarm for 5 minutes' time, just in case.
All right. Okay, it's called Portrait of a Girl. Dr. Malcolm Freeman, 16th of December, 1907. Mr. George Sotheby, Mill House, Treddington, Tewkesbury, Gloss. My dear Sotheby, Forgive me for being so mysterious in my last correspondence, but events of late have so consumed me, so tipped the solid ground beneath me, I felt I needed longer to absorb them before presenting everything to you as promised. You know me to be a man of science, only ever persuaded by empirical fact. But as of late, I confess to becoming increasingly a man of God. I know you will dispute the compatibility of these statements, and until recently I may have subscribed to the same view, but since the recent death at Grove End and the circumstances surrounding it, I'm not certain how else to make sense of it. I enclose a facsimile of Mrs. Calvert's journal. I implore you to read this first, and without bias, and please then tell me, dear Sotheby, what you make of it. For I was a player on the proscenium of that horrifying drama, a bit part in its unfolding. And now, for the sake of my own sanity, I seek your most valued opinion. Edith Calvert, Thursday, 7th of November, 1907. I am not normally disposed to journaling, but ever since moving to this house in late September with my new husband Percival and my rather spoilt stepdaughter Beatrice, I've begun to feel more and more inclined to chronicle some of the stranger incidents that have taken place here, partly in the event I should ever begin to doubt my own memory. Grove End, the agent told us, was established in the early years of the last century. It is rather remote, but comprises a goodly estate, and the house itself is somewhat large and impressive, with high ceilings, stone-mullioned windows, and stained oak panelling. When we viewed the property, I vowed to liking the grandeur of these details. The more time I spend within its confines, however, the more oppressive I find it, helped in no little part by the fact that a great deal of furniture and fittings were left behind by the previous occupants, including several paintings. One I find to be particularly disagreeable hangs in the entrance hall. It is of a young girl, not dissimilar in age to Beatrice. She too is blonde and blue-eyed, and she fixes the viewer with a most unsettlingly knowing expression. Her dress is of the most grotesque 18th-century confection, all pink, satin bows and ballet shoes. Atop it all, an absurd bonnet the size of a potato sack. What immediately strikes one as odd, though, are the long, black lace gloves she is wearing. When I get round to brightening the place up, this item will be the first to go. I should begin, I suppose, on that Saturday in early November. It was around 8 in the morning when I harnessed the retrievers, and eager to escape the stale air left for the nearby woods. I hadn't gone 10 strides when Beatrice, aged 7, that age where everything must be a question, asked if she could join me. Percy was away, and the girl had taken a strange aversion to being left on her own in the house. Reluctantly, I let her tag along if she promised to keep quiet, for I love the sound of birds and can hardly hear a note of their song with the child always chattering and fussing and scaring every creature within a mile. The air was unusually cold, and a layer of low mist still clung to the long grass in the field at the back of the house. As I walked, my breath condensed into spectres of vapour that rolled away as though joining their kin in unsolidarity. We were just approaching the trees when the child let go an almighty shriek, causing a black cloud of crows to burst from the high branches and bringing me almost to an early grave. In my state of alarm, I confess, I slapped the young lady across the cheek unthinkingly. I'm not proud of the fact, although I am to be convinced that any harm should come of such small chastisements occasionally. But there you are, it was done, and the girl began to weep. Don't cry, Beatrice. You only make things worse. Now, what did I tell you about making a fuss? I said, not unkindly, continuing towards the woods. After a moment, I noticed the girl wasn't beside me. I found her looking back towards the house. She was no longer crying. In fact, she seemed suddenly unmoved, unmoving, as still as prey. Well, are you coming or not? The wretch didn't speak. Oh, you're giving me the silent treatment, are you? I continued, half hoping she might give in and head back to the house. She had, however, remained so perfectly and uncharacteristically still, my curiosity was roused. "What is it?" I asked the back of her head. No response. Even her long blonde tresses seemed intent on stillness. "Beatrice," I said more sternly. And then, glancing up towards the back of the house to where the girl was staring, I thought I saw in the window of the girl's own bedchamber a face. There for only the most fleeting moment, before it retreated into shadow, but most assuredly a face. Was that why that looked like... I stuttered. At that moment, the girl seemed released from her stupor, and almost as though we had not had a crossed word, she skipped off happily towards the woods. I am not a woman of fanciful imagination, tending more to pragmatism than to superstition, so it wasn't long before I contented myself with a number of mundane explanations. The reflection of a cloud, a curious local child, perhaps, or maybe even a brief ocular disorder. When I asked Beatrice later that day if she'd seen anything in the window of her bedroom, she looked quite blank. "But you were looking at something, child," said I. "No, ma'am," she replied innocently. "Only the rooks on the roof and the way the sky goes from yellow to blue." I have been told that my dark eyes and raven black hair are the features that caught Percival's eye when we first met. Although older than my husband by some 7 years, I have, I suppose, always been considered somewhat handsome. He is 62, widowed 5 years ago after his wife succumbed to a riding accident. Suffice to say, it is rather an expectation of beauty I feel, and not vanity, that provokes the need for the hand glass I keep by my bed, for those times in particular when I am awoken by my husband, who often sleeps in the next bedchamber, and I am required to hastily improve my appearance. To return to events, that night I slept alone, as I knew Percy would be returning late. It was a fitful sleep. Sometimes I woke with the impression of that face in the window, projected on my mind like the persistence of vision retained on the retina. Other times I thought the bed alive with lice, for I had the sensation of my head and face being tickled by the tiny hairy legs of insects. Another still, I had the overwhelming impression that I could hear breathing, that someone was in the room with me in one of the dark corners waiting for me to sleep. In the morning, I was awoken by a noise at my door that I took to be a knock. Still very early, the room was shrouded in a black veil. "Percy?" I inquired, turning towards the door sleepily. When no answer came, I fumbled for the lamp beside the bed and lit it. As it displaced the darkness, I gasped aloud, for my pillow was strewn with a tangle of long black hairs, a trail of them leading across the bedclothes to the bottom of the bed. I reached for the hand mirror and peered at myself in horror. My hair was utterly disheveled, as though someone had been scraping and pulling at it all night. Needless to say, I stood and screamed, throwing down the hand mirror, which smashed at my feet, scattering shards of glass across the floor. In a state of shock, I knelt down, turning my back to the door to gather the worst of the mess. As I lifted the largest of the fragments, I glimpsed the reflection of something behind me. Someone peering around the door, a face half concealed by blonde ringlets, and a mouth bearing a grin so malevolent it sent a judder along my spine. I spun around, sucking in breath to scream at the little brute, but she'd already closed the door and fled. In that moment, my horror turned to ire. It was increasingly clear to me that when it came to his daughter, Percy was capable of little but indulgence. And so I marched into that malicious young lady's bedroom, where I found her pretending to be asleep, and I took it upon myself to dispense the most stern punitive measures. Happily, I did not see Beatrice at all the rest of that day. But the following morning, as I was doing the laundry, Percy entered the kitchen and told me the girl had taken ill, complaining of a headache. I suggested to him that it was likely the result of her shame rather than a real ailment. More probably, she didn't want to face her misconduct or the person at whom she'd aimed it. To this he countered that the girl swears she is innocent of any wrongdoing. "So my hair fell out of its own accord, I suppose," I retorted. Having no reply at hand, he left me for his study. Later, without my consultation, he sent a local farm boy to bring the physician, a Dr. Malcolm Freeman, who arrived that evening, most irritatingly as we were sitting down to our repast. As I introduced myself and ushered the jolly, red-faced old man out of the cold, he happened to remark upon a painting in the hallway. "Oh, you still display the Darnworth girl," he exclaimed. "That's as well." I looked around at that dreary painting of the absurdly dressed young girl. "This? You know the piece?" "Know the piece? I knew the girl herself. She resided here." At this, the man's smile curdled, and his eyes drifted back to the painting. "Well, perhaps you'd like to make me an offer," I smiled. He didn't seem to hear me. So, conscious of my rapidly cooling dinner, I remarked, "Well, please come through to the parlour. Percy will take you up to Beatrice's room. When the doctor had determined that Beatrice had a temperature but was at no immediate risk, he joined us in the parlour for a sherry. "You know, it's odd," he said, the firelight contorting his face. "When I saw your daughter lying up there in that bed, such a pretty little thing, it made me think of the Darnworth girl again." "The Darnworth girl?" asked Percy. "The girl in that dismal painting in the hallway," I explained. "I don't suppose you ever heard the story of Miss Darnworth?" "No, it is quite a tale, though not the happiest. Perhaps you'd rather not hear it, being as though it all took place in this dwelling." "Oh, I don't suffer superstition, Doctor. Please, go ahead," I replied. "Well, it was, let me see, late 1860s when the Darnworths moved in. Lovely young couple they were, filled this place with joy. For several years they had no luck conceiving a child, but then, in the summer of 1870, Emily was born. Such a lovely young girl, as you can tell from the picture. When the girl was a little older, Mrs. Darnworth contracted pneumonia and was ill for a period, so they hired a governess to look after the girl and educate her in the usual way for young ladies, ABCs, sewing and crocheting, and music, of course. But the governess was young and pretty, you see, and so, it was alleged, began to turn the eye of Mr. Darnworth. For a period, Mrs. Darnworth looked to be recovering, but then suddenly and inexplicably, her health deteriorated quickly. Soon after, despite every effort of mine and a renowned London physician, she died of no cause we could decipher. The doctor took a long sip of his drink and looked into the fire. Emily was devastated, poor mite, as you might imagine. Took to her room, spent every hour just sat at a window, looking out and crocheting. Worst of all, though, word got around that the governess, Miss Lister, was mistreating the child. Just rumours at first. But then, one day, I was called to see Mr. Darnworth, who'd come down with a fever. Afterwards, showing myself out, I heard crying. I found little Emily in a locked room, the back bedroom. She was wearing a pair of black gloves. When I asked her why, she wept. She told me Miss Lister made her wear the gloves when she'd misbehaved, to show everyone how naughty she'd been. The woman even had the painter add those black gloves to her portrait. Never seen anything of the like, to shame a child like that. Lock them up like a common criminal. A cold thing, Maud Lister. Not to Mr. Darnworth, though. Oh, no, not to him. I should have mentioned it to him then. Still chastised myself for not bringing it to his attention. But 6 months later, Mr. Darnworth and the governess were married. And shortly after, one sunny afternoon, little Emily filled her pockets with stones and drowned herself in the lake. The old man fixed us both in the eye in turn, a frigid half-smile on his lips. "That's what the coroner's report said anyway," he continued, raising a brow. "My God," whispered Percy. "So what's happened to the young woman, the governess?" The doctor's face seemed to sink, the tension in his jaw drawn suddenly tight as a knot. He glanced at his pocket watch and said, "Goodness, I'm afraid I really must continue the story another time." "You're not serious," begged Percy. "My apologies, Mr. Calvert. I didn't realise the time. I have an urgent appointment with Lord Maldon up on the ridge. Best not keep the Earl waiting." And with that, the old man rose and left, all the flushed jollity of his arrival quenched. That night, and perhaps inspired a little by Dr. Freeman's story, I thought it only right to call upon Beatrice and offer up a little absolution. Her bedchamber resided at the back of the house, as I've said, having favoured that room when we first arrived. It was located along a corridor, up a few steps, and around a corner. As I approached with a candle, my hand out to try the door, I heard the distinct sibilance of whispering. I paused, resting my ear against the door, but at that moment the sound ceased. I opened the door directly, to find Beatrice sitting up in bed. She turned to me, a haughty, knowing look upon her face. "What are you doing?" I inquired. "Crocheting," she said, returning to her task. "I didn't know you knew how. Who taught you?" "Mummy." "Don't be silly, Beatrice. Your mother can't have taught you. That would make you 2 years old at the time." "Well, she did, and then I just tried and tried until I got it right." "Very well," I said dismissively. There was no arguing with her when she was in these moods. "Well, Good night. Put that away now and lie down. You're supposed to be ill, remember? I forget that I'm poorly when I crochet. Well, it's late. Come on. I tucked her in and sat down on an armchair next to the bed. What were you whispering before? I inquired. I noticed her eyes glance towards the banquette by the window. Nothing. Sounded like you were talking to someone. I was praying. Oh? Praying for what? For Jesus, of course. Of course. 17th of November, 1907. There have been several nights and days with nothing of particular note taking place other than a general malaise that seems to have overtaken me. I feel certain, too, that something is happening to my hair. I'm sure it doesn't have the fullness it used to. It crossed my mind that I'm simply run down or overstating the truth, but then, to my utter consternation, even Percy remarked upon it Thursday last. My husband has left for a few days to oversee the takeover of some manufactory, and Beatrice and I are again alone in the house. And then, yesterday, something happened, though I can hardly bear to remember it. There had been an altercation after dinner, when Beatrice had, I'm quite certain, deliberately smashed one of my favourite glass goblets, and I'd sent her to bed early. I was very tired that night, and I don't remember falling asleep. But at some point in the early hours, I became aware of a noise, not from the door this time, but from something moving at the end of my bed. I'd been so keen for repose that evening, I'd neglected to close the curtains. So when I opened my eyes, the room glowed with melancholy moonlight. I lay completely still, listening, my mind racing with possible causes. A mouse? A rat? Had one of the dogs come in? After some moments, I plucked up the courage to glance towards the iron frame at the end of the bed. The first time I looked, I almost missed it. It was only when I rubbed my eyes and looked again that I noticed that there was just the shallow edge of something, mostly hidden, down behind the mattress. It looked for all the world like the very top of someone's head, as though someone were crouching there at the end of the bed, waiting. And then, somehow more disturbingly still, it ducked out of sight. The shock of that vision was quick to dispel the pall of drowsiness upon me, and in a moment of clarity, I knew it was her, Beatrice, up to her usual capers. I slid my legs out of bed quietly, a strange pleasure in the sudden chill that enveloped me, then slowly tiptoed across the floorboards to the end of the bed to catch the rascal at her game. Taking the final step quickly, I discovered the space there empty. I must have looked baffled then by the quick and silent way the girl had disappeared, but now it was very evident where she had hidden. The bed is a large cast-iron thing with long legs, making the void beneath big enough for someone small to crawl into. I had time now to luxuriate upon the uncomfortable discovery the girl knew was imminent. I took my time, kneeling down, talking to her as I did. "Oh, dear. It appears your little game is up. How unfortunate that you should be discovered and have to accept your punishment gracefully." But when I finally ducked my head beneath the bed, it was not Beatrice I found. Instead, there, crouching in the darkness, was a thing that I cannot now close my eyes without seeing. The room, of course, was dingy as it was, but under the bed all I could make out was a shadowy form that I can only describe as being not entirely unlike Beatrice, but an abomination of her likeness. In the brief moment I viewed it, before lurching away, screaming and running from that room, I observed that what I took for the head of that thing turned slowly towards me, revealing two tiny pinpricks of light where it looked back. A great swathe of hair fell over its face, so that the only feature I could make out in the gloom was a wide and unholy gouge of a grin. But the impression left most indelibly was the sudden reaching of that little hand towards me and the black lace glove that enshrouded it. 1st of December, 1907. Since that night, 2 weeks hence, I had begun to rationalize that awful vision as a waking dream, a kind of subconscious accumulation of all the unsettling aspects of this period of my life. It must have been a dream. And yet, this morning, having awoken, washed and dressed, on completing my toilette, I happened to view myself in the mirror. What I saw made me wish I could fall asleep and reawaken in my old life before this house, this marriage, before this devil child tiptoed into my world. Where once long, lustrous, jet-black hair cascaded from my head, now a ragged straggle of thin, tatty wisps dangle miserably from my crown. I cannot bear the world to see me, least of all that girl, who I'm sure, though I cannot guess how, is responsible. I've locked myself away in my room. Percy bangs at the door even as I write, but I will not have my beauty appraised whilst in this condition. I would rather die. Percy has sent for the physician. I know he suspects a mental infirmity in me, but since that night a week ago, I've hardly slept a moment, so it is hardly surprising I have not been myself. It is perhaps only this that has brought about the ailments that currently afflict me. I'm going to try and sleep now. I must try and sleep. I will update this diary when I awaken. Pray God that when I do, all of this will prove a terrible dream. And thus, Mrs. Calvert's diary ended, dear Sotheby. It is fitting that she invokes mercy. I arrived at that house not long hence, receiving no response from behind the door of Mrs. Calvert's bedroom. We broke it down to find that lady lying upon her bed, deceased. The young girl Beatrice, mercifully, was still in her room, quite unaware. Mr. Calvert, I attempted to calm with brandy in the drawing room while I saw to examining the deceased. But I delay in recalling the most disquieting part of the tale, lest it might disturb your sleep as it has mine. For when I found the lady, in much the condition she described, I discovered upon her hands a pair of black lace gloves. In and of itself, this might seem of no particular consequence, but what made me groan in horror was that, on closer inspection, the gloves appeared to be made of human hair, evidently of the woman's own long black mane. It dismays me to inform you, dear Sotheby, that I quailed in my duty to the Calverts then. I quickly removed those hideous adornments from the lady's hands, and in a moment of superstitious dread, committed them to the flame. Then I left that room, called for the coroner, and departed that house as soon as was civilized. But the full story I have not yet revealed, for I must complete the tale I began telling the Calverts that night by their hearth, the untold third act of a tragedy that befell the previous occupants of Grove End, of the Darnworths' lamentable lives. A year later, to the day that the Darnworth child died, late one evening, the new Mrs. Darnworth, that callous ex-governess, was discovered by Mr. Darnworth on the floor of their bedchamber, dead. But mark this. As he described it to me, when he rolled her body over, her face was fixed in the palsy of a scream, and on her hands, he remarked, she wore long black gloves. At the time, we concluded that her death was the result of a congenital heart condition. It was said her mother died of a hole in her heart. This I now think to be more right than we realized at the time, for I believe Maud Darnworth did indeed have a good deal of her heart missing. All of this I present to you now, dear Sotheby, for your greatly valued assessment. I await your prompt and dispassionate response keenly. Yours most sincerely, Malcolm. And there you go, it's finally over, lads.
Core blimey. Do you know what the spookiest thing about that is?
What's that?
Well, when I came in, it was Christmas, and now it's the summer holidays.
That is spooky. Yeah,
that was really good, that. Do you know, that was very evocative of, I mean, when you talk about hitting the brief, John, that was very Victorian ghost story-esque, wasn't it?
It caught the sense of time, didn't you? Like when you watch a period drama.
Yes.
Because I get bored watching those as well. So it's very much the same kind of... But it did, no, it tapped into the era very well, John.
Thanks very much. Yeah, that's what I was going for. I was going for the full experience.
It was an immersive experience.
Yeah. I love those ghost stories. I love all of those. And a lot of them...
You don't need to explain more, John. We've not got any listeners left. We can probably get off now.
Yeah.
Are we done? That was quite long. Sorry about that. I like the, what's it called? Epistolary form, isn't it? Like letter form.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
diary
yeah.
form and that kind of stuff. There's loads yes. of that in M.R. James.
Yes.
And it's almost like that period's version of found footage. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like sort of, almost like yeah, this kind true. Of Blair yeah. Witch paranormal activity.
But I was thinking about this. If we weren't doing it in that era, if you tried to sort of transpose it into the modern era, it would be a lot shorter, wouldn't it? Because it would just be like a load of text
yeah.
or kind of brief emails.
Emojis.
Yeah, it just yeah. wouldn't have any...
A couple of ghost emojis.
Wouldn't have anywhere near yeah. the same weight to it or presence.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. They knew what they were doing back then.
Yeah.
Again, they had nothing else to do, did they, but write really long letters. So
exactly.
Might as well. Also, the thought, just the very thought of wearing long gloves made of human hair, making my hands sweat.
A little bit itchy.
I imagine they'd be very
yeah, I think you're probably
thermally
right, yeah.
efficient.
I'm not sure if that would be possible to yeah. crochet some long hair gloves.
I mean, if you had enough hair and... Yeah. enough patience yeah. probably could, couldn't you?
I was trying to keep a sense. I like ghost stories that you're not like 100% sure yeah. if the person, or we talked about this, but whether the person's gone mad
yeah
or whether,
is it a reliable narrator, is there a
exactly.
gap between the two stories
yeah. yeah
and when you make it extravagantly and painfully long like that as well, you get to have that slow build, don't you? And that And so the reveal of something supernatural or spooky can be such a little gentle.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a boom. It can just be a
little tease.
Oh.
Yeah.
And that's what sends a little spikes and tingles down that's your spine, it, yeah. isn't it?
A little slip of the ankle.
I tried to make that description yeah. of the whatever it was under the bed just sound almost like as normal as possible, so that it could just have been Beatrice. There's nothing actually... innately horrific about that description yeah. at all. But I thought that was quite nice, because then it could have just been her. But it's kind of up to you how you imagine it. I quite like stuff like that, where you're not,
yeah.
you're never quite sure. Anyway, thanks for letting me read that out in its entirety and not just like the last page. That's very kind
the
of you.
Abridged version.
I'm not sure it would have made sense, yeah.
It's all right, yeah. It's just as you went through the pages, I was throwing them on the fire to keep it going as you'd finish each one. So yeah. it'll never be read again. But it was beautiful.
Who's next?
Well, shall I go next?
Yes, please.
Yes. All right.
So, obviously, part of our brief for this was the word count.
It wasn't that. Come on, it wasn't that strict a word count, was it? It was loose.
My story is 1,000 words long.
Show up.
Precisely.
Exactly 1,000 wow. words long. Right. Well, are we still sitting comfortably?
Hang on.
Yep.
We just... stretch.
Yeah, you probably want to move so you don't get bed sores, Dave. Yeah.
Someone needs to come in and turn me.
I can't really take credit for this story. I went down a rabbit hole doing research, all a bit weird, really weird. I was trying to find out what made a Victorian ghost story a Victorian ghost story, not being that much of a reader of 19th century literature myself. And I was looking at some old stories, and sometimes the line between fiction and fact seems to become blurred over 100 years or so. I became captivated by one story. The tale of Lily St. John and her husband Peter. They lived in Edinburgh in the 1890s, and everything I'm about to tell you is well documented in Victorian police records and coroner's records. It all checks out and has never been explained. Lily was the daughter of a successful railway engineer, Peter, the son of a Catholic priest. They were living a comfortable upper-middle-class life. Peter was a horror writer, eventually a pretty successful one. Even now, his books will come up in specialist auctions and sell for thousands. His last unpublished manuscript is said to be priceless. But he wasn't always successful. He started off writing comedy novellas, but they weren't very well received or very funny. And after years of getting less than favourable feedback, he found himself slipping into a deep fog of depression and writer's block. Every night he'd force himself to try and write, but he just couldn't. Until one night in April 1896, Lily hosted some friends and had a séance. They sat round the table, fingers on a glass, moved it around a bit, and they all went home happy, having heard from their great Aunt Maud, who died of consumption or whatever. Later that night, as he always did, Peter sat at that same table and tried once again to write. This time, there was no writer's block. Quite the opposite. He was writing like a, well, like a man possessed. The words tumbling effortlessly from his pen. He could barely remember what he'd written, but he sat exhausted with reams of finished manuscript in front of him. He woke his wife and excitedly begged her to read his work. Lily read it, completely absorbed by the deftly woven tale of deadly horror and horrific death. A chilling story of a local blacksmith brutally kicked to death by a cursed horse. It was a raw and harrowing story. It was a tale of fiction. But did it remain just that? 1 week later, a local blacksmith succumbed to injuries sustained from the horse he was reshoeing. His demise and Peter's tale were eerily similar. A mere chilling, but chance happening, they concluded. Then later that spring, as the sun went down, Peter sat at the same table, another story flooding into him and out, almost uncontrollably through his flowing pen. This time, a spooky tale about an old woman, accused of witchcraft, strung up in the woods, but whose soul escaped in the form of a black cat that seemed to appear from nowhere. Sure enough, a week later, an old woman was found dead in the woods. It seemed harder to write this off as another coincidence after the blacksmith's death. And it wasn't long before there were rumours around town of how, when on the mortuary slab, cat-like scratches were discovered on the old woman's abdomen, made from the inside. But like I said, that was just a rumour. And with all the investigations that Lily and Peter themselves had now been making to satisfy their curiosity, they may well have been responsible for starting that very rumour. But then came the other stories Peter would write. The young schoolteacher beaten and defiled by an unknown, seemingly invisible assailant. The lady of the night slit from neck to groin, hung up, and her insides emptied into the street like a butchered swine. And one concerning three generations of the same family, all trapped, splintered and devoured by the same accursed cotton spinning machine. One way or another, the horrific stories that fell from his pen appeared to come gruesomely true. They asked themselves, were they joining dots where there were none to join? Or were Peter's stories genuine premonitions? Or worse, was he causing the deaths with his writing? Peter had consulted with his father, a man of the cloth, though dared not mention the seance. Nothing more than a coincidence, came the instant dismissal. Death was a constant companion in those days, and a grisly end was not an uncommon event. But then came the last story Peter would ever write. He sat down on a dreek autumnal evening, the flickering oil lamps whispering out their light as he held pen to paper, waiting for that now familiar, otherworldly feeling to drive his hand across the page, churning out words as slickly as a magician summoning the ace of spades from up his sleeve. But this time, Peter St. John did not finish his story. Barely resisting the force imploring his every sinew to write, he stared at the page, and the words stared back. One in particular. His hand unwillingly lurched to the page, without his consent writing more horrific prose. He tried to halt the passage of the pen skimming across the paper, but with equal unearthly force it was made to return. Shaking, sweat beading, he wrestled against whatever power had him in its grasp. He fought and fought. The deep love for his wife giving him supernatural strength. He forced his hand to lift the fountain pen for the briefest of moments and spin it round, allowing him a split second to drive it solidly, deeply into his nasal cavity and then throwing his head forward with all of himself to the cursed table, stopping the story in its tracks. Lily discovered his body later that evening, slumped over that haunted table and his blood-soaked, unfinished story. His lifeless hand pointing to the manuscript, and one word in particular, Lily.
No. No. Hey.
That wouldn't be a very nice way to die, would it?
Fountain pen up the nose. No.
No.
Yeah.
That's all he could do.
That's good, that, Tom.
It's a good lasting image, that, Tom. Yeah.
I like the way it starts
Classic
off.
Tom, that.
It is. It starts off very sort of, you know, well, not sure if he started or not yet.
Well, that's what we learnt in our Halloween episode, you say.
Well, yes.
With the, a bit of understated realism or, well, this should be true. This is true. There's
could
some truth in
true,
it.
Yes.
Could this be true?
Yeah.
It's all, it's big idea, isn't it? It's big idea. It's classic Tom. Is any of that, because you said to me, Tom, that you were doing some research.
Yeah.
Is some of that based on some research? As in, I don't mean that someone died with a pen stuck up their nose, but was a little bit of it borrowed from actual people in some way or some story that was knocking around?
No, not at all. I actually said that to you to lay the groundwork for doing the story
better.
This way. It was all... Yeah.
That's really nice.
I went full Darren Brown on you.
Yeah, it was very nicely done as well, Tom. Lovely pacing.
Yeah.
Very good.
Nice little story.
Did make me think.
I hope it made you shit your pants.
That's exactly 1,000
exactly
words.
1,000 words, more importantly, Dave. And that's the thing, isn't it?
That's a competition entry there, isn't it?
I just find that irrelevant. It's just completely...
Anyway, in the interest of equality, I'm now going to read it a further 3 times.
No, we'll just talk about it for an hour. How about that? It made me think we should do a seance and try and contact some dead writers so we can actually finish some books for a change.
That's not a bad idea.
Let's do it.
That could work, couldn't it? If that is what happens, I wouldn't mind, you know, being possessed for a bit. It'd be quite nice.
I wonder if we could sell a bit of a soul each and make up one whole soul. Do you know what I mean? So none of us has to sell our whole soul.
Just a bit from you, a bit from
Tom.
That's clever.
Yeah.
And they could just have our soul while our soul's asleep.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm going to miss
that,
it.
Just that third of the time.
You just invented some kind of demonic timeshare, Dave.
I think I have, yeah.
If we can just invite the demons, the devil, to a conference, which includes a free holiday, but he does have to sit through a presentation.
Yeah.
We might be able to get this to work.
I actually, I sat through one of those once, a timeshare. It was a whole day. A whole bloody day.
How did you get talked into that?
Oh, I was really drunk.
Oh, I see. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah,
it suddenly all makes sense. Yeah.
It was in Vegas for my friend's wedding, and this guy came up and said, oh, do you want to, would you be prepared to just sit in a room for like an hour and listen to somebody talk? And at the end of it,
Dave, there were free drinks, weren't there?
We'll give you 2 free tickets. There was free drink. Well, it was 2 free tickets to a show.
All right.
All right, fair enough. And so I was quite drunk when I agreed to it, and I was quite hungover for the whole, and it went on for a whole day. Just people talking about these timeshare things, and on and on and on, and just thinking, can I go now?
When do I get my tickets?
Yeah, when do I get, you know, you don't get a ticket yet. If you leave now, you don't get anything. So, oh, God, I don't want anything, no. Anyway, about six, 8 hours later, I just said, no, I don't want anything. Can I have my tickets now? And they gave us these tickets to what was possibly the worst show in the history of Las Vegas. It was all a massive waste of time.
It wasn't going to be Celine Dion, was it?
It certainly wasn't Celine Dion, no.
There were lots of empty seats for... What was it?
It was this guy, a comedian, an Italian-American comedian, and somebody... I heard somebody in the queue saying... Oh, hang on a minute. I've heard that this guy's quite racist.
And, the things you want to hear in a queue.
Yeah. One of the ushers, or whatever they were on the door, said, no, he's not racist because he's horrendous to everybody.
Right.
And so we went in and he essentially, you name a minority group, he had a joke about them. So in that sense, it was equality at work.
You're fighting for equality, wasn't
Yeah, exactly, yes. It was just, it was awful.
Brilliant.
Really wasn't
Didn't
worth
like
it.
Didn't like anyone.
No.
Good story,
but,
though.
And that story is probably better than the ghost story that I'm about to read. Now, in the interest of balance, see, John's was over 1,000.
Mm.
Tom's was exactly 1,000. I think mine's a little bit under 1,000.
I mean, this is kind of working out perfectly, isn't it?
Although, in my defence, I haven't written anything. Yeah, I haven't written anything other than adverts for, all year, pretty much. I was thinking possibly since last year's Christmas panto might be the last thing I wrote.
Because that is a question that I was going to ask you later, is have you managed to write anything? But you have just answered it.
I've just answered that in advance.
So, Dave, is this 30 seconds long exactly?
No, it's a little bit longer than that.
Okay.
And in fairness, right, I can't say that I have listened religiously to every episode of the podcast since I've been
away. As in you've listened to one.
I'm honest like that. But one of the ones that I have listened to was the Halloween ghost story episode.
Yeah.
And I was inspired straight away to write this story. So the idea behind this story, I like. It just didn't quite have the time to give it the justice that I think it deserved. You know, you wanted me to write a story, so I've written one.
There's your excuses. You've laid them out. Perfect. Yeah, we'll take them.
It's enough apologising now, Dave.
Let's just get on with it. All right, here we go. All I know is that I mustn't fall asleep. They want me to. They don't want me to see what they're going to do, but they don't understand the truth. They think this old man and his young apprentice in their gowns and vestments, they believe that they're going to help me. These learned men with their books and their tools and their rituals, they believe they can separate me from this entity, draw it from my body, cure me. I try to tell them the truth, that we are linked, that our fates are intertwined. I tell them, remove me, and he dies. But somehow, it's not my voice. They think that it is speaking through me, that they can no longer tell us apart. My eyes are so heavy, the light's growing dim, but I must fight it. To sleep is to die. They've tied me to the bed. They say they haven't, but why else would I be unable to move? I struggle, and more of them rush in to hold me still, whispering soothing platitudes in my ear, telling me it will be all right, it'll all be over soon. And part of me does want it to be over. I've been tired for so long. It started with the visions. Blank spaces in the fabric of reality. And the headaches, migraines, or so I dismissed them. But as they became more frequent, I began to peer through, focusing on what wasn't there, magnifying the space. And as I looked through, it looked back. As time wore on, I felt it taking control, little by little, piece by piece, growing in influence and magnitude. My wife was the first to notice the change in me, a shortness of temper, a cooling of emotion, the feeling that I was detached. Now I look at the face reflected in the glasses of the old man as he shines a light into my eyes and recites indecipherable words, his hands mopping and etching shapes or symbols onto my brow, and I do not recognize myself. My face, my head, twisted and swollen. They say this thing is killing me, and yet still it says, no, you are killing me. Was that my voice? Chanting. Incantations, a chorus, words of power, or numbers spoken backwards, so hard to stay awake. My wife, crying, screaming from another room, get it out! Get it out of him! No, I reply in a voice that was never mine. He is ours. We sleep together now in hell. I awake. My face, my head, feels hollow, an absence. It is gone. I am alone. The doctors say it was a complete success. The tumour, the size of a lime, one of them says, was completely excised. Where is it? I ask in a voice I recognise as my own. Is it to be destroyed? No, not yet, the doctor replies. We have some tests to run first. I'm just taking it to the laboratory now, but I thought you might like to see it. Oh, yes, I hear myself say. Let us see what all the fuss was about. Light. I suddenly experienced light. I hadn't realized I was in the dark until the veil was removed and light poured in. No, not a veil, a lid. I'm looking at myself. I'm looking up at myself, looking back down at me. How? How can I see myself? I hear myself talking to the doctors. I hear my wife. I'm placed under my wife's face, and she looks down on me with absolute disgust. Take it away, please. Let us be rid of it once and for all, she says. And the lid is closed, and I scream as I'm carried away, but no one can hear me, and I don't know what to do, and all I can hear is myself saying, don't worry, darling. It's just me and you now. He is gone. Forever.
I like that, Davey.
It's very nice, that, Dave.
Quite like short, but, idea. You know, it's...
Very good.
It's, it taps in a little bit to the sort of the Victorian... It's got a very Victorian worry to it. You know, like they had a big thing about like being buried alive or like being possessed or swapped. And
I think live operations as well.
Exactly.
With people, like,
yes,
standing around watching.
Yeah, it's
But if I'd have had more time, I wanted to create more of that feeling of it being a bit like a sort of Victorian operating theatre type thing. But yes, not knowing what's going on. But yeah, it was that. I can't remember exactly what was said in that Halloween episode about. I think one of you mentioned it earlier on, the kind of not knowing if this is happening for real or if it's happening in someone's head. Sort of, is it possession? Mm. Is it mental illness? Yeah. That sort of thing.
It was like it was a nice double twist as well.
Yes.
Because you had you got the twist of it not being an exorcism, and then you got the twist of it not being the bit of him you thought it was, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It was very nice.
They've cut out the wrong bit, look.
Yeah, you got the wrong bit. It is a quite weirdly sad little story. And it did make me think, if you took a big bit of a brain away, would there be a little bit of it that was conscious?
Why are you taking me?
Do you know what I mean?
There was a bit of me that thought, is it a bit weird that the doctor would bring the tumour back and say, would you like to see what we've just chopped out of your brain? I think so, yeah.
I think they do that for everything.
I think that would have been normal in those times. My doctor once showed me a cyst that he'd taken out.
There we go then,
I think that's perfectly normal.
Yeah. I remember when we were in hospital a bit back and they did the same with a child that we'd had.
Presumably you didn't put that in the bin.
And they're like, look at this.
Remove this from your wife's body.
Yeah, whatever.
Pop it in the bin.
Whatever. Yeah, similar sort of thing.
Yeah, very, very nice. Yeah.
It was nice to sit down and write something.
Yeah, I bet.
For a change. It was lovely.
Well done, Dave. Yes. It's nice to have you back.
Oh, there we go. That was nice, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
Oh, we haven't done the little three-way writing thing for a long time, have we?
Well, that was... that was superb. I mean, I'm blowing all our trumpets there, but that was superb, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Should we hit a commercial break?
Yeah,
and then
I might have a little surprise guest for you on the other side if he turns up there. Just waiting for the doorbell to ring.
Another
knock
guest
at the door.
Okay, mm-hmm.
maybe.
Are you suffering from premature expiration? Wrenched from your mortal coil in an untimely and unfair way?
Yeah.
Still a bit miffed about being done in and thus no longer able to enjoy the new series of The Crown?
Too bloody right.
If this is you, and you're not ready to leave the world and pass on towards the light of infinite tranquility, then just... chug a can of Phantom! Phantom comes in three distinct and memorable flavors: gloom, putrefaction, and orange. But best of all, Phantom's powerful parapsychotropic formula will help you forgive, forget, and finally move on with your life. Death.
Thank you, Phantom.
You're welcome. Well, there goes another one. Good job they don't really know what's in store for them, otherwise we'd never get the floaty little buggers to move on. Shit, are you still recording? Oh, ghoulies.
Well, I might just go for a little stroll, stretch me legs a bit.
Go for a walk? You've been wandering the moorlands for the last 6 months.
Well, exactly. You know, I'm seasoned out. I've sat down all this time after being so free.
But you might miss Tom's special visitor.
Nah, I'll be back in a jiffy, mate. Honestly, look, just two ticks, not a stress.
Just don't get lost again, Dave.
Me? I won't, don't worry. When have I ever got lost?
All right.
I won't, I promise. I've got a great inherent sense of direction. I'll be straight back, all right?
We're not going to see him again this episode, are we?
If I know Dave, I'd say that's a distinct possibility. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm sure he'll find his way back eventually.
Oh, there you go. He's back.
Maybe he is. Oh, no, he's not. Come in, Neil McRobert from...
No
Talking
way.
Scared. Yes, I invited
no
him along.
No way. Hey, Neil.
Hi, Neil.
Evening, boys. How you doing? It is freezing out there.
I know this is really inconvenient, isn't it?
It's, it's massive.
Getting people to trek across miles and miles of Arctic tundra. Just But, you know, you're here now. Come on in.
I am, yeah. Fire on whiskey, please.
Yeah. We thought we'd ask you on, partly because we're fans of your podcast and you can give that a little bit of a plug. But more importantly, we've just read out our, I'm just going to call them, stories. We've read out our spooky stories, and we thought you might like to cast your eye over them and maybe say that one was better than the other. Maybe the longer one wasn't that good because it was a bit long or something. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Neil. It could be your own judgment. But yeah.
Well, the first thing I want to ask is, what were the rules of this competition?
Well, there was quite strict rules on word
length. There weren't really any rules, Neil.
Yeah,
they were very loose.
Right.
I think we wanted to try and give each other the chills a little bit. I think that was kind of the idea. And we had this idea that it would be a sort of traditional Victorian Christmas, you know, ghost storytelling.
Right. But essentially, John, you have, you know, I'll applaud Tom and Dave for packing a genuine story into so few words, because I can't do that.
It's a talent. Well, it's a talent, isn't it? Some people.
Yeah.
Something I've never mastered.
Some people just can't, Neil. Some people can't.
I've never written a story that under like 8,000 words that just sprawl and sprawl and sprawl. But like, John, yours is brilliant, but you did give yourself a lot more room to manoeuvre and create strong characters. So this comparison does feel a little bit unfair.
It does a bit, yeah, I get that. But I feel like that's important with those kinds of stories. And they're my favourites, you see, those sort of M.R. James kind of, you know. I mean, it was a golden era, wasn't it?
It
for
was.
Ghost stories.
Yeah. Do you want me to run you through my thoughts on all three and then
go on,
I can probably do a sort of cop-out thing where I find a way to make you all a winner because, you know, it is the 21st century and we need to be cognizant of these things.
We don't want any participation trophies here.
Right, okay, so here we
brutal,
go then, right.
Brutal realism, that's where we're at.
Right. Tom's story, first of all, right? I enjoyed, that's the first one I read, and I enjoyed the slightly meta start because I didn't know at first if it was like your narrative voice introducing it, whether you were just being really cash saying, I don't know what a Victorian story is, this is my, or whether that was part of the story, right?
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed that, bit wrong-footed a bit, and I do have a thing for stories that are overtly stories. Big fan of that.
Mm. Yeah.
Yours, Tom, has got the best single detail of any of these stories, which is the old woman with the cat scratches on her insides, which
yeah,
I just
nice,
think is inspired. And it's got a properly dark ending, which reminded me in a weird sort of way of Stephen King's Thinner, like that kind of nasty,
black. Copy a lot of my stuff, yeah.
I did think, to be honest. But yeah, nasty pitch black joke of an ending, so that was good. Dave, I've got serious beef with.
Okay.
It's a bit of a good job he's not here right now.
It is, isn't it?
I hope he trips on this walk because the two things I'm genuinely terrified of are stories about sleep demons, because when I was a kid, Freddy Krueger became a primal fear.
Right.
And the other thing that my listeners hear me talk about like three times a week, basically, is how much I don't like stories about possession. And this one is kind of sleep demons and possessions. It was like it was written to give me specifically sleepless nights.
Wow.
And it horrible, horrible story. Very good idea. And then, John, your novella. I do love an epistolary tale. I do. And I think it fits the mould. And I think, you know, the turn of the century era is my favourite period for spooky stories because there's just a weird time back then, right? It's like the modern world, but it's also might as well be 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
It's a bit of both the same time.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
No electric lighting helps, doesn't it, I think?
It does, yeah. It relies on gas and things like that. I think you always had the most wonderful grasp of voice. There's one line right early on where you wrote, I was a player on the proscenium of that horrifying drama. Which I thought, this guy knows what he's doing.
Poncy bastard, he thought. What a poncy bastard.
and then also, I've got to applaud you for that very creepy scene. Like, I know the thing under the bed is scary, but the scarier detail, very M.R. James, was the fact that at first she just sees the top of someone's head at the foot of the bed. Because that'd be way creepier than actually seeing a ghost, I think, you know?
Yeah.
So, With that said, you've all got points there.
Oh, that's good.
It is a tough one, you know. It is a tough one. I think I'm going to have to say yours, John.
Well, thanks,
right,
man.
I think I'm going to have to say yours is the best because it's got that masterful tone of voice. And I think it fits the bill of the Edwardian M.R. James Christmas Eve ghost story the closest.
Yeah.
But I think Tom and Dave, you kind of get separate wins for just doing what you did in such a short amount of time.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair.
That seems very fair to me. I'll take that. You see, this is what happens when you have an expert in ghost stories as a judge rather than just you and Dave, Tommy. Do you know what I mean? Someone who's able to see beyond the unfathomable word count. Hone in on the theme and the character.
I think it's more the fact that Neil is less tired of you doing that every time. So it's new to him. So it's less jarring for him, I think.
Are you a wordy bastard, John?
I can be. I'm not always, but I think I have. I've definitely written more words in these. But, you know, hey, maybe I'm just trying harder, Tom. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe. But I enjoyed them all.
I really enjoyed writing it as well.
Yeah. It's so nice having something like that where you feel like you're weaving stuff into it as well. So, do you mean, like with mine, it's a love story as much as anything because he sacrifices himself to save his wife, but it's part of him being possessed or mental or whatever. You've got all these different little channels. And I think you said when you were talking about yours, John, before, how you kind of, there's a lot for the reader to put into place and to decide, right, that is a demon or that's not a demon.
Yeah.
Did you have these ideas first or did you have to go, right, I need an idea for this competition?
I created mine out of nothing, really. John's was from a spooky tale about a picture that he...
Yeah, it was an Airbnb that had this creepy picture of a young girl, which may have been, I don't know if that was at the bottom of the story that you got.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. Oh, no, I did see the picture. Is that a real thing?
Yeah, so that was the...
Oh, I thought you just put that there to kind of curry favour with me and try and get me to vote for your story.
Did it work?
Right.
Is that what clinched it?
Apparently it did.
I thought, you know, it's like at school, you know, when you've got essays to write and you think, oh, I'll put a diagram in it for something.
Yeah.
It was like that.
Pop a picture in. Do a nice picture.
Oh, yeah, that is a well creepy photo with a little black gloves.
It really is oddly disturbing. Hey, listen, we were talking about being a fan of your podcast before, and I have to confess to being a little bit jealous because you had the writer of one of my favourite ghost stories ever on your show. In fact, the last one I listened to with Michelle Paver, who wrote Dark Matter, which is a brilliantly creepy ghost story.
Yeah, it really is. On the second time I read that, it freaked me out more. The first time I was like, okay, and the second time I was like, oh, this is genuinely horrible.
Yeah, it really is.
Bear post and all of that stuff.
It's the whole thing, isn't it? It's like the entire, you know, people talk about how important the location is in ghost stories, but in that, it is kind of the key character, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah. Very much, yeah. She was great as well.
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. And you got to chat to Stephen King as well. That must have been
That was a bit mad.
That must have been a pretty good day at the office for a horror fan like yourself.
I don't believe there is anyone alive who loves the work of Stephen King more than me. I would fight people to death for that. I always make this joke, and it's not a joke. I've got relatives who, if they died, I would be less bothered than if Stephen King parked it. You know what I mean? Like, genuinely, he means the world to me. And I'd spoken to a lot of famous writers by that point. But when he popped up on the Zoom call, it was one of the most surreal moments of my life.
I bet.
Same with Margaret Atwood. I mean, she was terrifying when all of a sudden Margaret Atwood was there. I was like, oh my God. But yeah, King was incredible.
That's amazing. Is he a fan of your podcast?
He listens to it now, yeah.
Oh, that's so good.
Where did your love of being scared come from, Neil?
You know, I get asked that a lot. Me dad, really. God, I went really northern then, didn't I? Me dad.
My dad used to lock me in shed when I was little.
Yeah, I went full on Kez then. my dad isn't a horror fan in the slightest, but when I was a kid, he talks a lot, and all he ever did is just talk to me about like myths and legends and books and stories and all of this stuff. And you know, when you're a kid, you latch on to like weird, spooky stuff. Yeah. I think. And I remember, I have this really strong memory of him talking to me, God knows why, when I was about eight, about the plot of Carrie.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Just being fascinated by it. Just being utterly... And then he also about Christine, because he'd seen the movie.
Mm.
And I remember really formative memories of thinking, like, oh, these stories exist and I want to read them. Mm. And then I've always been a bit macabre. There was like, you know, I always wanted the book where, you know, the Famous Five went to the Haunted Castle or the Hardy Boys went to the Haunted... You know what I mean? I never wanted the night. I wanted the spooky one always. And it just went from there and there and there. And I mean, it ended up me doing a bloody PhD in Gothic fiction, which has proved utterly useless in any walk of life.
I don't know. I think it gives you a certain... it gives you a certain caliber of, you know, an analysis. I think I imagine that it helps to attract certain writers.
Maybe, but it's also an absolute like weapon because I can't help but mention it. So it's just all the time. It's just the same people hearing me talk about that. I must sound like a complete dick. It's really not bragging. It's more to say that, you know, I really do love this subject.
More than
anything else. But yeah, so I've always loved it. I've always adored anything macabre.
Yeah, it's funny how those things tap into you when you're a kid as well. Isn't it? I remember being petrified. I think it was a school assembly. They were telling the story of the Minotaur. You know, when you're saying about myths and legends. Mm. And that just stuck with me for ages.
I mean, almost all stories that have survived have got some element of creepiness to them because they survive because they teach us something. And generally they teach us things that we need to know to stay alive.
Mm. Things to avoid.
Yeah, you know, there's you go all the way from like Grimm's fairy tales to the like Slender Man, and they're all doing the same thing. Mm. Just warning you not to go into the scary place on your own, basically. I love it. But I do get scared. I get more scared than I used to.
You do?
Yeah, I get way more scared than I used to.
That's interesting. You would have thought the more kind of ghost stories you read, the more you just get desensitized to it.
Yeah, the opposite. I've become mentally ill. Yeah, it's really not good for me. I just read horror books all the time, like every week, one or two horror books. And it's a sort of critical mass of nastiness that starts to wreak havoc. But, you know, there's worse problems.
It's true. Well, the really scary ones, they do get in your head, don't they? Mm. And they inevitably always work on you in the sort of the darkest part of the night when you're not quite asleep, but somewhere in between sleep and wake and you're just mulling over all these things. That's the real demon time, isn't it?
I mean, you're saying things that these are triggering words to me. So, but yeah, exactly that. Like that weird hypnagogic state. Mm. And yeah, I tend to lose the plot a bit. But I mean, it makes the stories more fun in a way. Sometimes it can go wrong. My wife is very patient.
I knew this would be a cheerful subject for a Christmas episode. When you said, John, I thought, yeah, this is going to be full of seasonal joy.
Yeah. Now we've chatted to Neil, I feel like we shouldn't just let him out into the night again on his own. I feel like he needs...
It's quite dark out there now, isn't it?
It is quite dark.
The eyes in the trees.
Maybe we need Dave to walk him down into the town.
I'm willing to sacrifice Dave.
I don't want to be anywhere near Dave with sleep demons and...
I'll tell you what, you can have the snowmobile. How about that? You can borrow the snowmobile.
Yeah, okay. Holleran snowmobile, back from the Overlook.
And if anyone fancies checking out your podcast, Talking Scared, we'll obviously leave a link in the show notes to it. And people can find it wherever they find the podcasts, I guess.
Yeah, they can. All platforms. The website's talkingscaredpod.com. That's quite new. And I'm on all social media at Talk Scared Pod. Not Talking Scared, Talk Scared Pod.
Right.
All of them, pretty much. Come find me.
There you go.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming to join us. Thanks for schlepping all the way up here.
No, thank you.
Roy. Back out into the wilderness with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and have a good Christmas.
There you go. Have a whiskey. Take that down with you.
Take that with you.
Thanks, mate.
See ya. Bye.
Cheers, Neil. Bye. So that pretty much ends. We're just going to finish with our date. He'll be back for the next one, will he? He's just...
Who knows? I mean, he's been wandering around for a year. Who knows, Tom?
Hopefully he'll find us again.
He hasn't got a great sense of direction, has he? But we'll keep the fires burning and hopefully Dave will be back.
For part two of our Christmas Victoriana spookathon.
We'd
never really came up with a name, did we?
No, we didn't. I don't know if you've noticed, listeners, but we're kind of over an hour in now and we've hardly scratched the surface of the stories we've got lined up. So
we've got a bunch of stories from people, listeners, who have kindly sent them in. So we'll be reading a selection of our favourites out in the next episode.
So this is not the end. This is not the end. And when's that coming out, Tommy?
That'll be out in about a week's time. New Year's Day, is that? New Year's
Day. It is New Year's Day. Yeah.
Always good. It's always very confusing at this time of year. But yeah, you're right. New Year's Day. Well done.
It is,
Full calendar marks to you.
Thank you very much.
Join us then.
Okay. Let's have another drink, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. See if Dave makes it back.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Thanks for listening. Yep. Take care of yourselves. Have a great holiday.
Speak to you next year. So it's only a week away. Yeah. But it's funny when you do that the night before, isn't it? We can't really. So, yeah.
Hello. Hello.
Where's everybody gone?